Hello, Sean.
Hi, George. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Very good.
So we're talking to you from your office, is that right?
Yes. I tried to do the home thing, but the phone technology just wasn't up to it. So the office here at Caltech is marginally better, marginally more technologically capable.
Well, I should say that you recently got an appointment at Caltech, the California Institute of Technology there in Pasadena.
That's right. It used to be little known, but now it's become famous because it's on Numbers on TV, so people know about Caltech.
Oh, that's right.
And I moved here just in September.
Oh, well, you know, I know the producer of Numbers.
Ah.
She writes some of the episodes. She's this really, really nice woman. She came to Santa Fe, at least a year ago, and we went to lunch out at my favorite place to have lunch with people in the Plaza Diner, and she was telling me about a new show that she was pitching to the people in Hollywood, and it was going to be based on a small scientific research institute, you know, something like the Santa Fe Institute.
Yes.
And she'd been up there talking to Jeffrey Wolf, the president of the Santa Fe Institute, and a fellow physicist.
Mm-hmm. This is before Numbers came out?
This was while Numbers was out. It was fairly new. I hadn't heard of it then, but then I started watching it occasionally, especially if she was writing an episode. But I guess she was pitching a different series that hasn't yet found a producer or money or however that works.
We Hollywood types would be able to explain to you. Yeah, there's a lot of development hell that goes on.
You know this stuff, right?
Now that I've moved to Hollywood, yeah, sure.
Well, I noticed your home phone number is 213 area code.
213, that's right.
So that's like the classic Los Angeles area code.
I actually live in downtown Los Angeles,
really?
Not in Pasadena. Yeah,
wow.
That's right.
Like near MacArthur Park? Or?
Yeah, so don't tell anyone, but the people who live in Pasadena is nice enough that the people who live here never leave.
Yeah.
So when I was shopping around for places to live, I decided I would not live in Pasadena, because it's nice, but I will come here every day.
Yeah,
downtown
Pasadena's
L.A.
Nice.
Is undergoing a renaissance.
Oh, I'd much rather live in Los Angeles than Pasadena.
Yeah.
Pasadena's always struck me as a little stuffy.
Yeah, you know, there's the Athenaeum, the faculty club with pictures of Einstein around.
Athenaeum. Yeah, Murray Gell-Mann called it the mausoleum.
Yeah. Right? Well, it's a faculty club. What do you expect?
Yeah, Italian Renaissance gaudy faculty club. I really liked it. I stayed there a couple of times in one of the rooms when I was writing my biography of Gell-Mann.
That's right. Now, I forgot that you must have haunted these very halls.
Indeed. I would walk. I would get up in the morning, and I even got to... I didn't stay in the Einstein suite, which is, I guess...
I did.
Did you? That's pretty nice,
once.
Isn't it?
That's very nice, the Einstein suite. Yeah, they gave him a good one.
I know my friend James Glick stayed there when he was writing his Feynman biography.
Mm-hmm.
No, I settled for a lesser room, but I did get the maid one morning to show me the Einstein suite.
Well, you're a good investigative reporter.
Indeed, yes. And then I would get up in the morning and I'd walk down the Olive Walk to the other side of campus.
Yes.
There were the theoretical physics department.
Well, that's where I am. I'm on the fourth floor of Lauritsen.
Oh, Lauritsen, right.
Sure.
Yeah.
Just across the other side of the hallway is where Feynman and Gell-Mann's offices were.
Oh,
and
okay. Yeah.
The desk in my office used to be Richard Feynman's.
Really?
So, yes.
Oh, that's great. Right. Is there graffiti?
There's no graffiti. There's a little sticker on the bottom that says Feynman's desk.
That's wonderful.
And we have looked at all the other desks, and none of them have a sticker saying Feynman's desk. So this must be right.
It must be.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Helen Tuck was the secretary that was... sat in between Feynman and Gell-Mann and got to
listen
to them.
It's due to her that this desk is still used by a physicist rather than in a Feynman memorabilia room.
Oh, well, that's
good. Continuous use.
I'm sure Feynman would have wanted that.
Yeah, I hope so. That's right.
Yeah. Well, I should say a little more about you. I think a lot of people already know you, who follow the so-called science blogosphere, and that started out doing a blog called Preposterous Universe.
That's right, yes.
And then this sort of segued, we always say segued in blogging heads, I noticed, into Cosmic Variants.
Mm-hmm.
I was just looking. I'm not really much of a blog reader, so I've been catching up on your work in the last few days, and I was amused to see that Cosmic Variants is a term that refers to the little core of unreducible or irreducible uncertainty that will always exist because we live in just one universe.
I'm glad someone gets
one
the joke
time.
Here. Yes,
that's neat.
Right.
Yeah. It's almost preposterous.
As you might imagine, there was plenty of talking back and forth about what the best name would be. We had a long list of 30 or 40 different possibilities.
And it's you and several other...
we have seven of us.
So seven now.
Total.
Yeah, right, you seem to be the most prolific. Is that...
Yeah, I am. I blog more than the others, but I think it's definitely a better place for having more than one person doing it.
Yeah, no, I think that's really good, too, because a lot of these things get so solipsistic after a while.
Not that that's bad, but yes, it's good to sort of be jolted out of your dogmatic slumber.
Right.
Co-bloggers.
And you've written about everything from, of course, theoretical physics and cosmology, and a lot of your research is involved with dark energy, or possibly the alternative to modifying gravity to explain why the universe is accelerating in its expansion?
Yes, absolutely. That's the big question in cosmology these days. I got lucky to be born at the right time as far as this is concerned, because I was a postdoc in 1998 when we made this tremendous discovery that the universe is not just expanding, but it's accelerating.
Yeah.
And so now the race is on. It's full employment for theorists. We need to explain this.
Yeah, I mean, that was really just came out of nowhere, didn't it, as far as what was established so far in theory and what people were expecting?
It came out of somewhere, not quite nowhere.
Yeah.
In fact, the reason why I was personally well-situated to think about it is that I wrote a review article in 1992 when I was a graduate student with Bill Press and Ed Turner about the possibility of vacuum energy, the cosmological constant.
Oh.
Something had been around since Einstein and bounced back and forth and was regularly dragged out of the idea hat to explain some unknown observations.
Yeah.
So everyone knew about the possibility, and they were interested in killing it off. And then in 1998, these groups said, no, actually, it's true. And they had, for the first time, actually pretty convincing evidence for it.
And this is, it's basically, there's energy in the nothingness of the universe that would propel such a cosmological expansion.
Yeah, the idea of the cosmological constant is just that in empty space itself, there is energy.
Yeah.
Even if you have no stuff, no particles, no light or heat or radiation, no dark matter or anything, every cubic centimeter still has a non-zero amount of energy.
Yeah.
10 to the minus 8th ergs per cubic centimeter,
ergs,
in case you need the number. And that energy has an effect, namely it makes the universe accelerate.
Yeah.
So now we've discovered the universe is accelerating, and this might be the cause, or there might be some other cause, so that's why we're writing papers about it.
Yeah, it seems like most of the science reporting you read sort of gives you the impression that everyone's on the cosmological constant bandwagon, but there are still alternatives that are being
I think that's exactly right. I mean, before we had the cosmological constant, we had really good theoretical naturalness arguments that it wasn't there.
Yeah.
And those arguments were not right.
Well, Einstein called it his greatest blunder,
right?
Famously read too many times, and every time people...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's you sit down and do a back-of-the-envelope calculation, and you ask yourself, if there could be vacuum energy, how much should there be?
Right.
What should the natural value be? And you get a number that is bigger than what we've observed by a factor of 10 to the 120. This ridiculous disagreement between theory and observation,
so it would have been
the worst ever.
So it seemed to be a case where you'd either have nothing or you'd have this huge amount of vacuum energy, and instead we have this little tiny smidgen of it. Is that?
Yeah, that's right. So I came up with an analogy for what this is like. Because people say, well, just because you know it's small, what made you think it was zero? And the answer is, so you're walking down the street, and you meet a guy on the street, it's late at night, he's like doing street performing, and he's flipping a coin. And he says, okay, you tell me whether this coin is going to come up heads or tails. And you guess heads, and he flips it and it comes up tails. And he flips it again and again and it comes up tails. And he does it 299 times, and it's tails every time. And so he says, okay, the next time, what are you going to guess it is? Now, you don't know what's going on. You don't know why it's come up tails every time, 299 times. But it's easier for you to guess that you're dealing with a rigged coin somehow, and it's going to come up tails again.
Yeah, yeah.
But on the 300th time, he flips it and it comes up heads. That's what we're dealing with the cosmological constant. Something is making it much, 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 much smaller, 2 to the minus 300 times smaller than it should be.
Yeah.
But it's not zero.
Yeah.
What kind of thing does that? That's a mystery.
Wow. So that's about as basic a question as, I mean, that's of course one of the big questions that superstring theorists have been grappling with. And
Well, that's right. If you claim to have a theory of everything, then everything should include the vacuum energy.
Right. I remember years ago talking to Eva Silverstein about that when she had just gotten one of those MacArthur Awards
are
called Genius Awards, to the great annoyance of the MacArthur Foundation for some reason. But
yeah, I'm sure they're very annoyed to get all that publicity.
Yes, right. Yeah, it must be a terrible thing.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we've been thinking about it. String theorists, of course, have been thinking about it. And for better or for worse, what happened when astronomers discovered that the universe was accelerating, that was a piece of data that string theorists needed to take into account when they were trying to reconcile string theory with the real world.
Yeah.
And before that, they were looking for versions of string theory that would give you zero vacuum energy.
Right, right. And that was hard
enough. And now suddenly, they need to give you a version of string theory that gives you a tiny but not zero vacuum energy.
Yeah.
And that did affect how string theory is done. That led to the whole landscape.
Right, right. Maybe we should back up a little bit and say, I remember, you know, we were talking about this the last time I saw you, which I guess was also the first time we'd actually ever met in
non-virtually.
It was when I was at the Kavli Institute for Theoretical Physics in Santa Barbara as science writer in residence. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think, maybe the first day I was there, and Steve Schenker, who's a superstring theorist at Stanford, was
grabbed
down
a bottle
there
of scotch in one hand.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
steered you into the ITP lounge.
Exactly, he said, I got a $100 bottle of scotch here, which is
it was more than 100, but yes, yeah, it was very very good.
More than 100, yeah, it was out of my league, but yeah, and he had lured us all into this place they call the Tower.
Yes,
wonderful,
that's right.
Second
a new part
story
of the
room
Institute
that looks out over the Pacific, and
yeah,
and you were there,
really.
And Steve and Joe Polchinski came in later, who's of course one of the real leading theorists in string theory, and I guess had much to do with introducing the idea that there's not just strings but brains, these multidimensional.
It wasn't just one dimensional thing.
Right, and then Eva Silverstein was there down from Stanford along with Shamit Kachru. And
there were a lot of IQ points in that room, and we were also there. Yes.
Yeah, and everyone was really, really very upset because Lee Smolin's book had recently come out, The Trouble with Physics, and so had Peter White's book, Not Even Wrong.
Not Even Wrong,
and they were, and the discussion was kind of, we're getting this really bad publicity, and we think, it's mostly off base, and how do we counteract that? And this was a theme that kind of ran through my entire 2 months there at Kavli, and people were really, really
upset.
There
was a string theory program going on while you were there.
Exactly.
It was just after,
right.
It was last fall, so it was just after the summer in which Lee's book and Peter's book came out.
Yeah, yeah, so the timing was just perfect for that to
a perfect storm, that's right.
The
and string theorists were like, we've been, working hard on our theory, and we like our theory, why is the whole world coming crashing down on us?
Yeah, yeah.
And in fact, New Scientist just had me write a little piece a few weeks ago, because on our blog on cosmic variance, I had mentioned that from what you would read in the media, you would think that string theory is all but done for, but actual string theorists are going along quite undisturbed in their research.
Right.
And they asked me to write a little one-page article pointing that out, because they said, our readers and our editors are convinced that string theory is in its last throes.
Right.
It's going to go away any minute now.
Yeah.
That is not actually the case. So you get a slightly distorted view of the view inside academia from just reading it from the books in the popular press.
Yeah, and I gave a talk about that, and where I was trying to make the point about how in some ways it's a coincidence that these two books came out at the same time, but that of course they mutually amplify each other's message, and people think, well, wow, if two of these books just came out, one out of left field and one out of right field, the same publishing season, and then it gets picked up by the blogs and starts resonating through the blogosphere, and Peter White has his own blog, Not Even Wrong, and then there's this character at Harvard,
Lubos Modl.
Yeah, Lubos Modl, who I guess is Czech.
Yeah, he's left Harvard now, actually.
Oh,
he's back in Czechoslovakia.
Oh, I didn't
so
know that.
So he's taken it upon himself to defend the honor of string theory.
Yeah, but in very, very nasty, nasty attack sometimes on people who question it. That was one of the themes that kept coming up when I was at Kavli and when we were drinking Steve's expensive scotch was, it's really not in our service that this is the person that, at least in the blogosphere, is being identified with being this pro-string theory guy.
Well, I've said this for a long time, that string theorists, they do think, and I think with some justification, that right now the public image of how well string theory is doing is not reflecting the reality of how it's doing. But, of course, in the past, it's been the other way around. It's been overhyped,
yeah.
And the public image might have gotten ahead,
yeah,
of where the science is by some substantial amount.
Yeah, so you swing from Brian Greene's book, Elegant Universe, on one pole to Peter White's book, Not Even Wrong, on the other, and the truth lies somewhere, of course, in the middle of the pendulum swing.
Yeah, but I think string theorists, I've often said that they are a little bit insular and unconcerned about their public image, and
yeah,
this is a very general notion of public image. I mean, even among working physicists who are not string theorists,
yeah,
a lot of string theorists prefer to just do their research and just do string theory, and you can't blame them. That's what people
do. Yeah, that's what it's all. I mean, it's really kind of a fairly modern phenomenon where a group of theorists would have to worry about their public media image.
Well, it depends on what you mean by, again, the public. I mean,
yeah,
it's true that, hiring a PR firm is something that is probably beyond what most academics would prefer to get into.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if we do specialize in some recondite technical area, part of our responsibility is to explain to other people what we are doing and why we are doing
it, and
why it's worth doing it.
Yeah.
And one of the points that I make is that this perpetuation of string theory within the ivory tower is not a self-perpetuation. String theorists need to be hired, and they need to get funding.
Yeah.
And for the most part, the department chairs and the people at NSF and DOE who are doing the grant allocations are not string theorists.
Yeah.
The string theorists have succeeded in convincing their colleagues within physics that what they're doing is something worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it's also a kind of a unique project because they've been going for years and years now without any direct contact with experiment.
Yeah.
And I think that even within the physics community, some people's patience is beginning to run thin.
Right.
They want to see some results, or they're going to say, you know, why are we putting so much of our effort, so much of our very scarce resources in terms of faculty positions or something like that,
yeah,
into a field which still hasn't quite paid off.
Well, yeah, Sheldon Glashow, the Harvard high-energy physicist, Nobel Prize winner, recently made a rather snide comment about superstring theory. Did you see that? This is not his original one about comparing it to theology years ago, but something about superstring theorists are so clever that I'm sure they'll come out with a way to explain any experiment in terms of superstring theory. That was kind of the gist of it. But,
well, it's a little bit unfair,
yeah,
because string theory is trying to do something really, really ambitious.
Mm-hmm.
It's trying to extrapolate from physics that we know now many orders of magnitude past what we have experimental access to these days.
Yeah.
So it's by no means a surprise that string theory has not yet made some specific experimental,
yeah,
prediction.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't make such a prediction for the next 10 years, it still won't be a surprise. It still will not mean that string theory is not right.
Right.
It just means that it's hard.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's a very, you know, if the critics of string theory had as their main point the claim that, look, you guys are just too ambitious. You're just trying to do something that we don't have the technology to do now. We should keep closer to home,
mm-hmm,
I think that would be a much more compelling critique than most of the ones that I've actually heard.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and Lee's critique, Lee Smolin, I noticed was that on Cosmic Variance where Joe Polchinski reviewed Lee's book and it ended up in this really interesting dialogue that's kind of gone on and on for a while.
That's right. Lee is a frequent commenter at our blog. And
yeah,
so Joe wrote a review for American Scientists.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and
okay,
the beauty of blogs, it's really hard these days for me to write or contribute to non-blogging,
mm-hmm,
things, because blogs have no space restrictions. I can be as sarcastic or as personal as I want, et cetera, et cetera. So
yeah,
both Joe and I separately reviewed Lee's book, and we had versions of our reviews that were longer and had some more details that couldn't fit into the published version.
Oh, okay, so you were able to
put them on the blog, and there not only can we expound at whatever length we want, and not only can we have footnotes that go into more technical detail, but then there can be a give and take,
mm-hmm,
in the comments afterward.
Well, I noticed that one of the points that Joe Polchinski had really objected to in Lee's book was that Lee was saying that when dark energy was discovered, that this had been so completely out of the blue and just it hadn't been predicted by superstring theory at all, and that this precipitated this crisis that led to this idea of the landscape, where there may be 10 to the power of 500 different superstring theories, leaving us to wonder why we happen to live in this, you know, one particular instantiation. So I guess, again, that's the cosmic variance problem.
And there was a, and Joe sort of took objection to the way that that was portrayed, and I think that I'm coming down on Joe's side in this debate. I don't think it's even fair to call the landscape business a crisis. It's what happens when you get data, and you use data to inspire you to build your theories in a better way. Mm-hmm. So that's what happened. Mm-hmm. Whether the landscape exists or not is a true-false question, not a good versus evil question or right-wrong question.
Yeah.
But, a lot of people, before the supernova results came out in 1998, thought that the cosmological constant was zero. We were all trying to come up with theories that had no vacuum energy, that space was flat and would be unaccelerated. And within string theory, it was thought that that would be easier to do than to come up with theories where the cosmological constant was positive.
Yeah.
There's all sorts of technical things here. Like, no one was really saying that you couldn't have a positive cosmological constant, but they were saying things like you couldn't have a positive cosmological constant that was truly stable and things like this.
Yeah.
And then, of course, when the vacuum energy was discovered, if that's what it is, the fact that the universe is accelerating, they said, okay, well, we have to deal with this, and so they are dealing with not quite stable vacuum, and they find 10 to the 500 of them.
And, yeah, that was this paper by, it was Shamit Kachru and...
Shamit Kachru, KKLT.
KKLT,
Yeah, Kalosh, Linde, and Trivedi.
Right, and that basically went from saying, well, now that we have to accommodate this idea that we do have this cosmological constant, or we possibly have it, and it's not huge, but it's actually rather small, how do we explain this with superstring theory? And it led to this idea that... it would be so unconstrained that you'd have the 10 to the power of 500 different universes, each with different laws.
Yeah, and that's so, but it's not. This is not a choice that you have. This is either what string theory predicts or doesn't.
Yeah.
And it's still an open question. It's not absolutely set in stone.
Yeah. And could you talk a little bit about why that's called the landscape, just for
The general idea is that the good news is that there, as far as we can tell, is only one string theory. And in fact, it's not even string theory. It's something called M theory.
Right.
And what we used to think were the different versions of string theory are actually just different limiting cases of M theory. That's the good news. And then you run into a bunch of bad news. The bad news includes the fact that when you say, what is M theory? You say, well, it's the theory that has string theory as different limiting cases. It's very difficult to give a once and for all short description of what M theory itself is. We're still not sure in different circumstances.
Yeah.
The other bad news is that when you say, okay, you have this M theory, what kind of versions of M theory look like a four-dimensional world?
Yeah.
We live in a world that has three dimensions of space, one of time. We know that there's different versions of M theory that look 10-dimensional, and there's even a version that looks 11-dimensional. How many are there that look four-dimensional?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is there's a bunch. There's possibly 10 to the 500 or some ridiculous number like that.
Yeah.
And these are like different phases of space-time. It's not really different theories.
Yeah.
It's like you can have ice or water vapor as different phases of water. You have three different phases that we're familiar with.
Yeah.
This is saying that space itself has 10 to the 500 different phases.
It's called a landscape because we have this image of like this multiverse, which we can think of as this multi-dimensional landscape with peaks and valleys, and each little nook and cranny is a different one of the 10 to the 500 universes?
Yeah, we have this idea that there's a whole bunch of parameters, a whole bunch of fields that can take on different values, and it's like a ball rolling down some very, very complicated set of hills.
Right.
And of all these different parameters that can take on different values, the ones that can sit there and be relatively stable are the ones that correspond to minima, sitting at the bottom of a valley in that landscape of possibilities.
Okay.
And there's just a bunch of them. And if that's true, then you have to deal with it.
Yeah.
And whether or not you like it or not does not affect whether it is true or false.
I mean, it seems that When I really first started following super string theory after, I don't know, was it the second revolution or third revolution, but it was shortly after Polchinski's paper introducing brains and all these other interesting objects, and it became M-theory, which some people said stood for magical, mystical, right, or mother of all theories. And at that point, I think the big message that was coming out, at least in the articles that we were writing as journalists, was that, well, yeah, it does seem crazy, this idea that we could have 10 dimensions of space and all of these strange multi-dimensional objects within this, but the price is that when all the details are figured out, it will point to one unique theory. This will show why the universe has to be the way it is. And instead, it's led to the landscape where we're saying that maybe the only way we can say the universe is the way it is because of the anthropic argument that, well, you know, it happened to be the way it is because it could produce beings like you and I who could sit around and come up with super string theory. So,
well,
to me, that's what we found
a
so
little
dissatisfying.
Bit. Well, when you say that the way that it is because it had to be that way to come up with us, I mean, I would say it as the idea is that we live in a universe where conditions are very different from place to place.
Yeah.
And we only arise in those parts of the universe where conditions let us arise.
Yeah.
And that's not really surprising at all. I mean,
no,
my analogy
that's,
is
yeah, I know what you
within
mean.
The solar system, we arose on the surface of the Earth.
Right.
We didn't arise on Mercury or on Jupiter or in between the planets.
Yeah.
And nobody is surprised, even though Jupiter has a lot more surface area than the Earth does.
Yeah.
So maybe the universe is like that. Maybe the universe is not like that. We're trying to figure it out, and we'll just have to live with whatever the answer is.
Well, isn't, I mean, the landscape, I mean, it's really one of these powerfully, what would the word be, tautological arguments that, I mean, it's obviously true.
No, it is not. It really, really is not obviously true.
It seems tautological to me in a way, and I don't mean that negatively. I mean, it means tautological to me in the same way that that variation and natural selection is tautological.
But it's not. It could have been different. It could, you don't need natural selection.
Yeah.
You don't need to have descent with random variation.
Mm.
You don't need to have the genetic information that is passed down from generation to generation be digital rather than analog, which is necessary for natural selection to work.
Mm.
Likewise, there's a tautological version of the anthropic principle that says we can only exist in conditions under which we can exist. Duh, that's kind of tautological.
Yeah.
We don't really explain anything by saying that. But there's also a non-tautological version that says that conditions in our universe that we observe which appear to us to be unnatural are only appearing unnatural because the part of the universe we observe is one element of an ensemble.
Yeah.
So we have numbers like the cosmological constant or other numbers that we measure in particle physics that we say, that's not the number we expect. This is very surprising to us. It could be that there is an explanation for these unnatural numbers in terms of a measure over some ensemble of possibilities.
Yeah.
If that's right, it is not tautological. It could be wrong.
Mm.
It might not be true.
Mm.
So if all you use the anthropic principle for is saying that conditions in the universe are consistent with us being here, that's sort of useless and a waste of time.
I see.
But if instead we're asking, should we be looking for a unique dynamical explanation for the value of the vacuum energy?
Mm-hmm.
Or should we just be able to live with it because if it were its natural value, we wouldn't be here?
Yeah.
That's a theoretical choice that has ramifications. It's not tautology.
Yeah. But though, if you have this ensemble of possibilities and such a huge ensemble it apparently is, doesn't this really abandon the original promise of superstring theory as giving you the unique theory?
Well, the answer that I kind of want to give to that question is I don't care.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what the theorists said about string theory when it was originally introduced. What I care is whether string theory is right or wrong.
Well, of course.
I don't want to blame the theory for the shortcomings of the theorists.
Yeah.
And this happens all the time in cosmology, which is what my actual specialty is.
That
a new theory comes along and the theorists say that it predicts something, and it doesn't, because they're sort of taking a shortcut.
Yeah.
And then that thing that they predicted turns out not to be right, and they have to backtrack and say, well, actually, our theory is still compatible with the data for this reason.
Right.
So it was true that the hope of string theorists in the 1980s was not only that the theory was essentially unique, but that within a few years we would use that uniqueness to solve all of our problems in particle physics and make unique predictions for what would appear at particle accelerators in the near future.
Yeah.
And that didn't happen.
Right.
And that's too bad, and it's not string theory's fault.
No.
It's string theorists' fault.
Right.
And the world is what it is. If someone comes along with a better theory of quantum gravity that does everything string theory does and is unique, people will switch to that.
Yeah.
That's all you need to do.
Yeah.
But it's hard.
Yeah.
So actually, I was interested, I wanted to mention, in this context of sort of thinking about the challenges to string theory from the point of view of the general public or reporters thinking about it, there's an interesting parallel, I don't know if you noticed, that about economics.
Mm-hmm.
And the New York Times reported on this just a few days ago, and there was an article a month ago in The Nation that really set it off about the discipline of heterodox economics. Have you seen this?
Yeah, remind us what that was.
So the idea is that there's a set of economists who are, you know, respectable people in the sense that they're professors, and they even, you know, they publish real articles, and they even sometimes win awards. But they think of themselves as heterodox because they're challenging what they see as the mainstream, ultra-free market, rational choice theory kind
of viewpoint. Mm-hmm.
And there was an entertaining article in The Nation about, you know, going to a conference and seeing how the heterodox economists are sort of marginalized in the basement rooms of the conference and so forth. And it really reminded me of this sort of loop quantum gravity or dynamical triangulation or whatever version of quantum gravity versus the mainstream consensus of string theory.
Yeah.
And not necessarily that academically the two are analogous, but from the point of view of an outsider trying to understand it, there's a problem here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're facing with a technical, sophisticated, mature academic field in which you are not an expert, and you talk to people and you find that there's a subset of these people who are respectable and have faculty jobs, but think of themselves as a minority with viewpoints and techniques and practices that are not quite shared by the majority.
Mm-hmm.
And they think that they're thinking outside the box and contributing something deep and profound.
Right.
But they're complaining that they're kept out of the best faculty jobs and the best journals and the best awards and stuff like
that. Yeah, right. So basically what Lee Smolin is claiming.
It's a very analogous kind of rhetoric.
Yeah.
But if you talk then to the people who are purportedly the establishment, they say, you know, we're not oppressing these people because they don't buy into our orthodoxy.
Mm.
We just don't think they're right.
Yeah.
We just think that they're wrong.
Yeah.
And so why should we be giving them faculty jobs if they're wrong or their research is unpromising or something like
that? And those of us who are on the outside looking in as spectators and physics fans are have no real way to judge whether or not
these people are really deep and profound,
but
rocking the boat, or they're just wrong.
Yeah.
And I actually don't know the answer to this problem as an outsider. How do you judge the difference between those two things? Because you can certainly hear very intelligent and articulate insiders taking opposite sides of the different things. So,
but this, is, to me, is what makes it so exciting, just that sense of intellectual ferment and of so much still being up in the air. And
yeah, I mean, the in the context of blogs, I mean, you mentioned some of the bloggers who go back and forth about this, and despite what people might have guessed, scientists are just as many drama queens per capita as any other occupation.
I know.
And they all tend to appear on the internet in different forms.
Yeah, yeah.
But the good news is that it really means that people are very passionate about this stuff.
Yeah,
it might seem a little esoteric and recondite, but you know, people care about whether or not space is really four-dimensional or ten-dimensional.
Right.
Which is kind of nice.
Right. Yeah, this whole superstring popular culture is a rather amazing development.
Well, yeah, as a cosmologist, I get the same thing. I mean, I'll be sitting out there at dinner by myself reading a technical book on cosmology, and 50% of the time the server will say, you know, what book is that? What are you reading? And, you know, explain this to me. And people really love this stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that as a community, even though people like Brian and Lisa Randall and Stephen Hawking have done a great job at bringing some of that excitement to a wider audience, I still think the demand is dramatically underserved by really, really good explanations of some of the ideas that we're thinking about.
Yeah.
There's plenty of people who want to know more.
Yeah, yeah. And if they look at the right blogs, I mean, I've learned a lot from reading some things on cosmic variants, and often, you know, the posts are, you know, beyond my level of expertise, but often they're not. And I mean, you've written about everything from hunting dinosaur bones to science and religion, and yeah, there's a nice review you did. It was a review of a review of Dawkins' book.
Of Dawkins' book,
yeah,
right.
The God Delusion. That was a very, very nice erudite essay, which seemed, you know, quite a lot about the...
Which,
theology,
which in the old days I would have sold to some magazine and gotten paid for it, but now I give it away for free. Yes.
Well, yeah, that's the great thing about all of this. Yeah, we get paid in the very low six figures.
Right, it's, you know, we do it for the glory. And
the very low one figures is what
but,
it is.
The
very low zero figures.
I think this is an interesting thing about blogs, and it's actually a source of a slight amount of tension between bloggers and their readers, because blogs can be anything.
Yeah,
they can be very technical. They can really be, among scientists, a way to share research ideas and talk about stuff at the cutting edge. They can be very non-technical. You can have a scientist who blogs and never mentions science on their blog, or likewise a literature professor or an economist or whatever. Or they could be something in between where you either try to explain things in a way that is more accessible, and maybe sometimes you talk about things that are not science at all.
Yeah.
And a lot of your readers want you to be one of those or the other, and the thing is that you're not being paid to blog. You can blog about whatever you want.
Yeah.
So we blog about what we want. Sometimes we talk about physics. Sometimes it's in a research way. Sometimes it's in a, you know, back to basics, let's talk about the simple harmonic oscillator way. Sometimes we talk about what we had for dinner last night or what concert we went to, and that's what makes it all fun and exciting to me.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing to be able to, like, look over the shoulder while someone of the caliber of Joe Polchinski and Lee Smolin are arguing with each other somewhat informally, like in the pages of Cosmic Variants or on Not Even Wrong. And it's something that the general public has really not had the opportunity to do. I mean, us science journalists sometimes get in on these at conferences or stumbling into hallway conversations when we're reporting something, but just to have so much of the raw material of the debate out there in the infosphere.
Yeah, I think that personally that is exactly what is the single biggest nice thing about blogs, is that you can sort of see the sausage being made, right?
Yeah.
You can see that science is not either a pristine edifice of correct truths that is gradually accumulated, nor is it a sequence of press releases mentioning astounding discoveries.
Right.
It's an ongoing process.
Right.
People
right.
disagree, they talk, they're smart, sometimes they're respectful, sometimes they're less so. The downside of that is, of course, if you read the comments, it's sometimes hard for the outsider to know which comments are by people who are Nobel Prize winners and which ones are by people who have their own theories of everything that they came up with there in the basement.
Well, yeah, especially when so many people are posting with, you know, whimsical nicknames. And
yeah, there's a lot of people out there who are pretty sure that they have figured out stuff that has stumped generations of establishment scientists. But that's also, you know, part of the fun of it. So
yeah, because in the past, really, you know, people would read Science Times or Discover or Scientific American, and you would get these occasional snapshots that would kind of freeze frame the field that you were interested in at a certain moment, and then now you just have this continuing, you know, this continuing sausage making mess that you can follow if you're so inclined, and it's wonderful.
I think so, but I think also, for whatever reason, I think it's an interesting sociological phenomenon that physicists in particular and scientists in general have been slow to take up blogging compared to other areas of academia. I mean, physicists like to claim pride for inventing the World Wide Web. It came out of CERN. But when I tell my physics colleagues that if you go to economics or political science or law professors, the most famous, well-established people have blogs.
Yeah.
It's not just, you know, wee quirky few.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They're a little bit astonished. Like, really? They actually waste their time doing that kind of stuff?
Oh.
And I think that in fields where the engagement with the interests of people on the street is a little bit more immediate,
mm-hmm.
the idea of talking to a wider audience is not quite seen as much of a waste of time.
Yeah.
And I bet that 20 years from now, that will be true in science as well.
Yeah.
That more people will understand that this is not just a distraction from the real work.
Yeah.
That not only discovering new things about the universe, but talking about those discoveries in this informal context is
yeah.
a useful contribution.
Yeah. Just trying to imagine what the 60s would have been like if Murray Gell-Mann and Richard Feynman were blogging away.
Exactly. Isn't that the greatest tragedy that we don't have that?
Yeah, yeah.
Because you know that if one of them set up a blog, the other would set it up tomorrow.
Oh, yeah, and they would compete on who had, you know, the really,
more
really coolest
so
software
that's
and the latest, you know, Ajax programming. And
yep. Absolutely, yes. That is too bad.
Yeah, that's another thing that I think that's wonderful about Wikipedia, just sort of continuing this theme of the wonderful messiness of the internet, and I just love Wikipedia, and yet people will say, well, yeah, but how do you know if you read something there that it, you know, someone hasn't just, you know, come through 5 seconds before and, you know, inserted some ridiculous error, and yet that seems to be happening less and less, and there's so many little proofreading enzymes in the in the form of all these other Wikipedians that are, you know, everyone monitoring a few articles and protecting them against vandalism. And out of this, you get a pretty good reference. It's something I would
Absolutely.
Never use as my final reference. But for me, the lesson is that there is no final reference. And you shouldn't use Britannica as your final reference either.
Good. I think that you've gotten the right lesson. So you said exactly what I would have said there, which is, you know.
You always want to get things from as many different sources as you can and make sure the different sources aren't just echoes off the same source that are,
right.
you know, ricocheting in the infosphere.
And Wikipedia has the benefit of being, you know, having a lot of stuff and having it much more easily accessible than anywhere else.
Yeah.
So why not use it as your first place to go?
Yeah.
When I was writing a paper a few months ago about the cosmic microwave background, I needed a certain recursion relation for Legendre polynomials.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have any books with me, and so I looked it up on my laptop on Wikipedia, and there it was.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course I went back and checked it in a real book
exactly.
later before
yeah.
I published it, but
yeah.
Why not use that? I think it's great.
Yeah, I've been using it. You know, this week I got the copy-edited manuscript back for my next book, The 10 Most Beautiful Experiments, and sometimes I'll just want to really quickly check something. I mean, I know, it absolutely know it's right, but I'll get this nagging feeling, and I know it's when you're absolutely sure something's right and you decide you don't need to check it that it'll turn out to be wrong. So sometimes if I'm
yeah.
really in a hurry, I'll just
yeah.
go onto Wikipedia and I'll figure, well, what's the chance? I know I didn't use Wikipedia as my source, but what's the chance that they would make the same random error that I did?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's very amusing to read, you know, the Encyclopedia Britannica has blogs now. And they're defending
yeah.
their turf as much as they possibly can.
Right.
You know, trying to talk down Wikipedia. But, you know,
well,
there's actually about me in Wikipedia, not in Encyclopedia Britannica.
Exactly.
So my loyalties are clear.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's just so many, yeah. So many times I'll turn to Britannica. I'll turn to that first. I subscribe to their full edition and have for years. And sometimes I just won't find something.
Well, for current events, Wikipedia is amazing. There are people who really
yeah.
put things in there very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And it's changing. I think that the iPhone is another step towards this. I mean, pretty soon every person in the world will be connected everywhere they are.
Yeah.
That's going to be a different kind of world.
It's all happening so much faster than I ever thought it would happen.
Yeah, we just got our first car that has a GPS system in it, and now I don't know how I ever got anywhere.
I haven't made that leap yet.
You become dependent on it very, very quickly, yes.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you said we, which gives me another nice segue into, I understand that you were engaged to not only a blogger, but a science blogger.
That's right.
And
so
it's Jennifer...
Jennifer Ouellette.
Ouellette. I wasn't sure if she used a French pronunciation, like that nice little beret she has in her cartoons of herself.
Yes, that's right. Jennifer blogs at Cocktail Party Physics.
Cocktail Party Physics.
That's right. And she's a science writer. And her two books are, one is a collection of little essays on the history of science, mm-hmm. called Black Bodies and Quantum Cats, and her other one was written on a dare, and it's called The Physics of the Buffyverse.
Buffyverse. Oh, this is Buffy the Vampire Slayer?
That's right. It's the Buffy the Vampire Slayer version of the physics of Star Trek.
Oh, so she's following in Lawrence Krauss's estimable footsteps.
That's right.
Oh, this is good. We'll be sure. We'll send, when we're done with this, you can email Brian links to these.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah, I started looking at her. You referred to her, I guess her blog basically chronicles your, I mean, not in any detail, but you're meeting each other at a conference somewhere and your courtship. And
well, actually, yeah, both Jennifer and I tend to blog not about personal things and our love lives or what restaurant we went to last night.
Yeah.
But we decided that because we both met through our blogs, that is actually how we met, that we should at least post once we got engaged. We should tell our readers that we both got engaged to each other. And that happened in November. We told the world.
She did refer to you by name and not just as future spouse?
No, yeah, back then we did admit that we had names. Ah. And so that's okay. So now we've just become future spouse. And it was really interesting to see the reactions to our engagement post, mm-hmm. though. I mean, we got quoted in Nature magazine about the fact that we were getting engaged, which I think is the first engagement announcement I've ever seen in Nature, only because we met on our blogs. That was really cool. And in the New York Times also, it got in there. And so she's moved to Los Angeles now, but she's a science writer, and our blogs are actually very, very different. She can write. She's really good at writing, and I think her shortest post is longer than my longest post.
Well, yeah, I noticed she's writing, it's more like essays.
It's a skill,
Well, do you do that, too? I mean, I noticed that one person, I think you said this yourself, that one of your posts, I think it was the one on Dawkins' God Delusion book was vying for longest blog post ever.
Well, there was that was an accumulation of many, many things. I mean, another topic that is worth some dissection is the relationship between religion and science blogs.
It's my second favorite topic, I think.
Yeah, it's going to be quite the popular thing, for better or for worse. But I have an unusual upbringing because I'm an atheist, but I did go to school as an undergraduate at a Catholic university at Villanova.
Oh.
So I've taken, many semesters worth of courses about religious studies.
Oh,
and
so that's why you were so up on Duns Scotus and Aquinas and...
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly not an expert. I'm not going to claim that I'm an expert.
Yeah.
I pretend to do that. But,
but
I've been exposed to a lot of these things, and I taught a course with a friend of mine at the University of Chicago on the history of atheism, which is a very understudied subject, the history of atheism.
Yeah.
So we learned a lot, and we had a lot of fun.
Yeah, there was a nice theme in that post where you were talking about basically the history of religion as being this contention between two forces, and one being the ancient Greek conception of God, and the other being the Jewish tribal Yahweh kind of God, and that this tension is something that just constantly exists to this day in religion and leads to all of these really basic contradictions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I think that not only is it true that there's famous theological conundrums that basically come down to one or the other version of can God make a rock so heavy that he himself cannot lift it?
Right.
But not only do they exist, but they can be traced historically to the different kind of conceptions of a monotheistic God. We started out with a pantheon, which is kind of silly to imagine. It's sort of very obviously mythical and anthropomorphic to have a god of love and a god of war and so forth fighting each other. But it fits the data pretty well in terms of, we live in a messy world. We don't live in a world that is very, very strictly ordered and has everything happening nicely. So having a bunch of gods that are warring with each other kind of makes sense from that perspective.
Yeah.
So if you want to sort of say that, well, there's only one God, and God is omnipotent and omniscient, but yet we still live in this messy world, you're going to face conundrums. Yeah. And Aristotle and the Greeks got out of them by saying, well, God doesn't mess with the world. God just is the prime mover and is sort of some imminent force.
Yeah, the old deistic God that so many of the 19th century physicists were perfectly happy with.
Absolutely, that's right.
Mathematicians.
And there's sort of a theologically respectable stance along those lines.
Yeah.
But then people also want to believe that praying to God makes a difference.
Right.
And it's
right.
Reconciling those two ideas that is really, really difficult.
That's what really struck me, you know, a couple summers ago when I was in Cambridge, England at this Templeton Science and Religion thing for journalists. And we'd listen to these people like John Polkinghorne, mm-hmm. and we'd read people like Keith Ward, mm-hmm. and they were not at all satisfied with this deistic Greek idea of God just set the machine rolling, and now we can, if we choose to, we can, you know, talk about, oh, God is just the wonderful, beautiful order of the universe, you know, the way Einstein sort of misled people into thinking he was religiously devout. And,
right. Well, there's a lot of different versions of sophisticated theology. That's the thing. I mean, to me, there's a version of materialistic atheism mm-hmm. that is kind of simple. You know, the world is made of stuff, and the stuff follows the laws of physics, and that's everything that there is, except that you can look at it in different ways, and that's a lot of fun. It's a very simple and understandable conception. And people say, well, if
anything that doesn't explain, in principle, can or will be explained in the future, but
you're
not positing the supernatural. You're not just saying that there's this supernatural realm which is off limits. I mean, you know, what in the world could that mean?
Well, I posted just the other day about this question of whether or not, if you do believe in such a thing, mm-hmm. should you feel happy or sad that that is the case?
Oh, yeah, what was that Karl Rove who made that bizarre?
Karl Rove tried to sort of squeeze himself into a politically acceptable position by saying that I am not fortunate enough to be a person of faith.
So someone had put him on the spot and asked him if he was a person of faith?
In particular, Christopher Hitchens.
Oh, Christopher Hitchens asked him that.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So obviously Karl Rove can't say that, you know, no, I think the whole God stuff is silly, given his position.
Yeah.
But to his own credit, I think, he was at least honest enough to say, no, I'm not a believer.
Yeah.
But he wanted to sort of stick that in there, that he was regretful that he was not a believer.
Not fortunate enough to be a person of faith.
That's right. So I asked the question, you know, should we, you know, forget about whether it's right or wrong. Mm-hmm. Forget about whether or not God does exist or whether the world is just laws and forces. Mm-hmm. What would we prefer to be the case? And so I set up, you know, just for purposes of discussion, set up a little thought experiment, you could choose which was the case. Mm-hmm. And of course, people come in the comments and say, well, the choice I want to make isn't either one of the two you gave me. Because, you know, I think the materialist point of view is kind of simple and straightforward, but there's an infinite number of ways that you could not be a materialist. And some of them are going to be very, very deistic, very, very Aristotelian, very, very unmoved mover, immanent, transcendent God that keeps the universe going but doesn't interfere with anything.
Yeah.
Some are going to be very fire and brimstone, you know, as soon as those Jews build the temple, God is going to come down and smite your asses.
Yeah.
And there's a million things in between where, you know, I have seen very respectable theologians use the anthropic principle to argue in favor of God, saying, you know, the fine structure constant wouldn't have the value it does if someone didn't make it exactly that value.
Right. And for me, and presumably you, the same argument could be just used to say, well, it's obviously that it's obviously just what's wonderful fluke, and it has nothing to do with
it. It could be a fluke. It could be environmental selection.
Yeah, it could be environmental selection. It could be the part of the landscape argument, or it could be written into the laws of physics, and we just don't understand them yet.
Yeah. So I actually, I don't disrespect people who are intellectually serious theologians or religious
people. No, I don't either.
Because I've been exposed to these people when I was an undergraduate and also later, and some of them are brilliant, and they think very, very carefully about what they believe in.
Yeah.
But there are so many versions of that belief that it's hard to engage once and for all with one of them, because someone else will say, well, that's not my version.
I mean, I just assumed before I went to Cambridge, without knowing much about it, that scientists, physicists like Polkinghorne, who are also very religiously devout, embrace some kind of deism, and I was very surprised to find that they are actually indeed theists who believe that God answers prayers and intervenes and nudges the history of the universe or even of civilization this way and that, and they would try to come up with ways to justify this using say quantum mechanics or chaos theory, and it just seemed to be this amazing amount of special pleading to try to become comfortable in your own head that the science you've learned throughout your adult life is somehow compatible with the religion you happen to be taught growing up as a child.
Yeah, and it's, again, there's all sorts of different positions one can take along that spectrum. You'll see people who say, well, that idea that the vision of the Virgin Mary hasn't appeared on a tortilla is ridiculous, but Jesus really did rise from the dead, you know, three days later, and sort of everything in between. So, and some of it is the physicists who become religious and think like that are often not at all the most sophisticated theological believers.
Yeah.
I had a, when we taught our course on atheism, we had both of the two of us, Shadi Bartsch and I, who were teaching the course, were atheists. So we thought that, to be fair, we would bring in a guest speaker who was not, but nevertheless who was an expert on the history of atheism. Yeah. We brought in Father William Buckley from Boston College, who was an old, very, very charming Jesuit priest who came in, and he was a University of Chicago alumnus. So he gave some great talks to us and very, very sort of close-reading, old-school, Chicago-style academic.
Mm-hmm.
But at some point he turns to me and says, "You don't think that I believe in G-O-D God, do you?"
Right.
I said, "Well, you know, I kind of thought that maybe as a priest you would believe in G-O-D God, but, you know, his viewpoint was much more sophisticated than that."
Yeah.
And physicists who use the fine-tuning of the laws of nature to argue for God are rarely that sophisticated.
Yeah, yeah.
But how did you find your experience at the Templeton retreat?
It was really... It was very educational as far as just learning why people believe things that before I found completely inexplicable. And now I can see how you could, you know, with great efforts, convince yourself of certain things, like an interventionist God. But mostly I was struck by, we were exposed to the people who were supposed to be the sharpest thinkers in the world on this, one of them being John Polkinghorne, and part of... what we did during the fellowship was we had 2 months back home in which we were just supposed to read, and they gave us $1,000 each to buy books,
okay,
which is wonderful.
They let you pick the books? Or?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And so I read a lot of this stuff, like Polkinghorne, Keith Ward, and...
Swinburne, maybe?
Yeah, yeah. And I even went back and read some interpretations of Aquinas and really steeped myself in it. And we came back again and heard arguments from these very sophisticated physicist believers, and I still came away thinking that, wow, if we've just heard the strongest ammunition that they have, it's not very persuasive.
Yeah, one of the nice moments I've had in my academic life was I gave a talk at a theology conference, at a conference on God and physical cosmology.
Wow.
And Richard Swinburne was the organizer, and it was supposed to be about, you know, a bunch of philosophers and theologians come together to talk about natural religion, how you can go from the observed universe to conclusions about the divine.
Yeah.
And for entertainment and enrichment purposes, they asked a couple of real cosmologists to come in and talk about cosmology.
Yeah.
Joel Premack and I were both asked.
Wow.
And when I was asked, I said, "I'm very happy to come, as long as I don't have to talk about cosmology. I want to talk about religion."
Yeah.
And so they said, "Sure, you can do that." And so I gave a talk about why I'm an atheist and why you cannot go from observations of the natural universe to conclusions about the existence of God.
Yeah.
And afterward, and they loved it because they thought that they were actually getting something that they weren't usually told. They, you know, whether or not they believed it, they were at least hearing a perspective that they sort of suspected was out there, but no one's really sharing with them.
Yeah.
So afterward, you don't expect at a conference like that, after a talk like that, to change anybody's mind.
No.
You're just trying to sort of share with them what you're thinking.
Yeah.
And that's fine. That happens at conferences all the time. But afterward, one of them did come up to me and said that I did change his mind. Not about the existence of God, but about the argument from design.
Oh.
The idea that you could look at the world and discern in it some patterns that were evidence for a designer of some sort. And he said that before my talk, he thought that was plausible, and afterward he realized that it was not going to work.
Yeah.
So that was very nice. It was very refreshing that someone would actually change their mind on the basis of hearing it.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you just pick up a crystal that you find walking on the trail and see this embedded three-dimensional geometry. And, you know, how can you not think that design can arise without a designer? But
sure. No, I mean, if you didn't know any better, if you didn't have the laws of physics and you didn't have Darwinian evolution and you didn't have our notions of cosmology, I'd be completely willing to believe that the stuff we see out there in the universe had some purpose behind it.
Yeah.
But I would still be suspicious because, you know, the world is still a messy place.
Yeah.
You know, the world is full of chaotic, crazy disasters.
Right.
So it's certainly not a very good fit, even from the start.
Yeah, it's just a wonderful tension between order and randomness.
That's right. And I think that, you know, I always just refer back to David Hume's Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, which did a great job of completely eviscerating the argument from design even before it was fully articulated by William Paley and others.
Really? So this was before Paley finding the watch on the heath?
Exactly. He did not find the watch and the rock and so forth. Before he'd done that, Hume had basically showed that it was silly.
Didn't he say that, it just doesn't get you anywhere, because then you're going to have to figure out a theory for who designed the designer, and
among other things. And he said also, the really good point, I thought, was that even if you bought this, what conclusions are you going to be able to safely draw about the designer?
Yeah.
Is it a committee? Is it a graduate student? Was it a mistake?
Yeah.
You know, there's just very little from
that. Is it a simulation running in a...
that's right. Are we just, you know, in the Matrix and so forth?
Right,
these are all
really
good questions.
Yeah, you can't, it gives you nowhere to go from there.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And one of the side benefits of the blogosphere is that this is a debate that is happening a little bit more out there in the open.
Yeah.
I think that blogs have actually played a role in that. Because, you know, a lot of working scientists, for very, very good reasons, don't want to be bothered. For the same reasons they don't want to be bothered in selling their work in some sort of PR sense.
Yeah.
They don't
want
to sort of use their positions as scientists to talk about things like religion or other things outside their purview.
Yeah.
And I sympathize to that. I think that's right in some sense. When I talk about religion or whatever, I don't say, look, here I am a physicist and this is why you should believe me.
Yeah.
I try to make an argument and have people actually believe the argument or disbelieve the argument.
Yeah.
But there's a perspective you get from being a working scientist that you can bring to these questions.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not you have any special insight is debatable, but you shouldn't be forbidden from talking about it.
Yeah. Well, some people would argue, and maybe this is a quote from Dawkins, I'm not sure, but that you can't believe in miracles and be a scientist.
Well, again... I think that one of my criticisms of the new wave of atheism books by Dawkins and others, even though I generally agree with their conclusions, is that they tried to be too comprehensive in their critique of religion.
Yeah.
They didn't only say it was wrong, they said it was bad, and then they tried to call
bad
it some,
and stupid.
Yeah, evil,
yeah.
The cause of all the problems of the world, and they tried to come up with some evolutionary psychology explanation for why people are religious. And it diluted what I thought was a possibly good message of the book, which is just that if you think about the world scientifically, you don't come to the conclusion that there are any supernatural forces at work.
Yeah, so you're more of the view that it's something that has outlived whatever usefulness it had in the past. And
well, no, my view is that I don't talk about its usefulness. I want to talk about whether it's right or wrong.
Yeah.
Just like with the landscape in string theory, it may or may not be encouraging or discouraging. It may or may not make it harder or easier to make predictions. What I care about is it right or is it wrong?
Right.
And likewise with religion, there are certainly good things that religion does. Religion makes people happy in certain circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
It leads to good charities. It gives people a sort of social locus of their communal lives in certain circumstances, in addition to various bad things that it might do.
Yeah,
but
it's not very good at explaining.
If it's not right, then I would prefer to find other ways to get those benefits that do not rely on statements about the universe that are not right.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are able to, you know, some very good scientists are able to be religious believers, but they don't use their religious beliefs as the basis for their their physical theories.
Right. I mean, that's why I don't want to agree with Dawkins's quote that he just said, that you can't be a good scientist and believe in miracles, because there are plenty of good scientists who believe in miracles.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
empirically, there are plenty yeah. of people who do great science as a matter of fact,
yeah.
and yet are religious.
Yeah.
You can't deny that.
I think most people like that compartmentalize and really have just, you know, two different ways of thinking about two different things, and in some ways the subject matter is completely different anyway. I mean, you can certainly easily be a deist and have that and have all of your physics subsumed into that, but I don't think most people try to reconcile them or subsume one into the other, and it's just you know, just a few people that feel compelled to do this that, you know, drive a lot of the debate.
It is interesting, though, that on the physics or biology or science blogs more generally, the percentage of talk about religion is much higher than on the economics or law professor or
yeah.
English professor blogs.
Yeah. Well, it's, I know it's something, whenever you write about it, you get, you know, more email than you do about anything else. And
right, and people say, why are you talking about this? And you go, well, somehow people seem to be interested in it.
Yeah,
it seems
yeah.
to matter to people, and it affects
yeah.
the world. So
yeah.
I think it's worth writing about, yeah.
Well, I guess we've managed to talk more than an hour here. This is
we've gone past an hour. We didn't even get to the plates, which is
yeah.
too bad.
I'll just mention them briefly. You know, whenever I spend so much of my time writing about a lot of this really cutting edge theory, and, you know, the superstring theory, M's theory, the landscape, the dark energy problem, and I like writing a lot about science and religion and philosophy mm-hmm. of science. So just recently it was nice to do this really down-to-earth, very basic story that I had in the Science Times on Tuesday about this beautiful collection of glass photographic plates at Harvard Observatory there in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yeah, I actually, as an undergraduate, I spent a year at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics.
Oh, that's
summer,
right.
Rather.
So you were there up on Garden Street.
That's right. I was there for the summer, and then
yeah.
I later went back for graduate school. And I was, at the time as an undergraduate, I was not doing fun theoretical cosmology. I was doing fun observational stellar astronomy.
Mm-hmm.
And my undergraduate advisor, Edward Guinan, used those plates to collect data, photometry
yeah.
data about stars. And they're these big pieces of glass that are photographs of the sky from 100 years ago or so.
Yeah.
And people say, what possibly, well, good can they be? They're not as high quality as what we have now, which is true, but the sky changes. The sky
yeah.
is not always the same. And knowing
yeah.
what stars were like 100 years ago
oh, it's amazing.
Is invaluable data.
Oh, it's, I mean, basically they have covered the entire sky, southern and northern sky, for 100 years with
right.
anywhere from hundreds to more than 1,000 pictures of each spot of the sky, all on these glass plates, 500,000 of them, you know, tons
yeah.
and tons of glass, and they're just starting this project to digitize it.
That's right.
Stitch
yeah,
it all together into this online map. It's just wonderful.
And they need money, if anyone out there listening has $2 million to slide their way.
Yeah.
But I want to say, George, that was a great story, actually.
Oh, well, thanks.
I very much enjoyed reading it. And it's also true that if you compare science as it is practiced to science as one gets a feeling for it by reading it in newspapers,
mm-hmm.
stuff like theoretical cosmology and string theory and so forth and particle physics is vastly disproportionately represented
yeah.
in
yeah.
the imagination. And it's great to see all these wonderful stories about the nitty-gritty of how real science is done and the
yeah.
fact that, you know, we need to know how many of the grains on this photographic plate were exposed 100 years ago at this telescope in Massachusetts, and how that affects what we think about how
yeah.
stars evolve.
It's just wonderful getting down to the basics there, and looking at the old journals in which they, you know, wrote in cursive with fountain pens. And
yep. Well, this,
yeah.
this is why I enjoy blogging about my trip to Wyoming, going dinosaur hunting.
Oh, yes, right. That must have been great.
It's such a different tangible experience than...
Yeah.
My
yeah.
professional work, which involves going to Starbucks and sitting down with a pencil and paper and writing equations, and I relate those equations to multi-billion-dollar experiments that people do in the mountains or in the sky.
Yeah.
But a lot of science involves, you know, hopping in an airplane, bringing your burlap with you, and going out there on your hands and knees and digging. And
yeah.
That's still a lot of
yeah.
how it's done, and that's how it needs to be done.
You know, I loved reading about these old astronomers, or, well, they weren't old then, but they were these these young astronomers mm-hmm. going all over South America and climbing to the top of mountains looking for the perfect place to set up a telescope and expose these glass plates and then carry them down the mountain on muleback to ship them to That's Boston right. Harbor.
That's right. And, of course, the Harvard computers, the women who were employed.
Yeah, yeah. Like Henrietta Swan Leavitt.
Right. Without whom we wouldn't know how big the universe is.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, those were the days.
Yeah. Well, Sean, it was great talking to you. Let's do this again.
All right, great, George. Yeah. Thanks for inviting me. I had a great time.
And do you suppose that the future spouse might want to do a show with me?
Future spouse would love to do Blogging Heads, I'm sure. I will
excellent.
Speak for her.
Yeah, please ask her. Yes.
Would I will
good.
Ask her. She would be great.
Oh, excellent. Okay, well, we can, I guess, press our stop buttons here and then ship this off to the home office.
Okay, great. Thanks,
okay,
George.
Sean. Bye.
Bye.